Hey folks, and welcome to the Daily Ratings Podcast. It's a show where each week we'll sit down with Vincent Daly to get his thoughts on the latest movies he's been watching, both older films and new releases. And don't worry, there's no spoilers. Vince will give a brief review of the movie, share some thoughts, and of course, then rate the film. The Daily Ratings are always fair, honest, and most importantly, they're consistent. On today's show, Vince will be rating and reviewing In the Mood for Love, directed by Wong Kar-wai, Ghost World by Terry Zwigoff, Babel by Alejandro G. Iñárritu, Sisu by Jalmari Helander, and finally newly released The Little Mermaid, directed by Rob Marshall. It's going to be a great show, folks, so stay tuned and enjoy. Vincent Daly, how we doing, buddy?
Hey, Tommy boy, how's it going?
It's going okay on my end. How was your week of movies now that you're off the fast train?
Quite the random week. Folks, Tom gave me the green light to be like, hey, watch some movies for you this week. And I was like, all right, we're chipping away from the list.
You surprised me. When you sent me the list of what you were watching, I just wasn't sure about all of them.
Yeah.
What I mean? And then I like that we're stepping back into the Alejandro.
Yes.
Because this is our second last.
Second last, yeah.
Yeah, before we complete kind of our director study. But it's nice to jump back into that because we've been so busy with other stuff.
He's been MIA for 2 months now, basically.
Yeah, I'm glad that you had a week where you're like, all right, let's watch hopefully some good movies or what you thought was good movies.
We had a tragic passing as well. Did you hear the news? No.
Tina Turner?
No, not Tina Turner.
No, go on.
We have a tragic passing in the film community, a true hero that spit at the trend chasing and what was best for fellow film watchers and fellow man. The HBO Max app has been replaced with Max, my favorite app. Absolute favorite.
I don't think it's that different at all, right?
Oh, it's terrible.
Okay, what about it?
Everything is.
Let's go into it. Here's a little review. Let's go into review.
Where are my curated hubs? I loved that we had these hubs of, I don't know, Studio Ghibli or Criterion Collection or
still have
TCM.
That.
I haven't found it. What do you mean?
Okay,
got the hubs?
If there's a TV behind me right now, yes. And it's funny, Studio Ghibli's right on there. In fact, I like the hubs. I think they were more present.
Okay.
You go on the homepage. Okay. Hold on. You go on the homepage. And you click down like two rows.
Two rows?
Everything is there. Cartoon Network.
Okay.
Because Discovery Now, because, you know, they're finally trying to. So you got the Discovery schlock on there.
Right. My 1,000-pound sister or whatever.
All the car shows and everything like that.
Polluting.
I don't hate the app. I find it to be very similar.
Yeah?
And, yeah, the hubs are there. And it is a little bit more content, too. Wander through it a little bit.
I'll wander through it a little bit more.
I thought it was seamless.
I was crying. I was in tears. As soon as I logged into HBO Max and it was just like, you gotta download a new app. I knew it.
But how easy was the process? They saved all the history too. Everything
was
seamless.
That is true.
I was reading reports that it was like, oh, it crashed, it failed, yada yada. I had no issues. I went on,
really?
It made me get the new thing.
I
didn't even need to put it. I don't even know what my password is.
It just had it,
and it was just like, no. You're still good. We got your stuff. Succession. We got where you're at. It's all good.
All right.
No issues.
Fair enough.
No issues with
Fair
Max.
Fair enough. I was maybe a little bit more doom and gloom on it. as I opened with, we had a tragic passing.
Yeah. Screw Tina Turner. My Max. Yeah. my HBO Max back.
My HBO Max. Why is everything three buttons now? That's a nitpick.
What do you mean? Everything's
three buttons. I don't know what you mean. And then your watch list. I don't know. Why don't we do something with
it? Like a little bit more?
Yeah, give me a little bit more.
I would like a little bit more, too. Okay, all right. So
he's done with the.
Did
Max
you even watch? Did you watch any of these on Max? Were any of these on Max?
In the Mood for Love.
Oh, okay, all right. Yeah. Okay, well,
look at that. good transition.
Let's start off right away. I was definitely in with these first two films. Pretty, just not knowing much.
Sure,
I did some research on them and everything like that. So I'm excited about it now.
Sure.
Let's jump back to the year 2000. This film is called In the Mood for Love. It is directed by a director known as Wong Kar-wai or Kar-wai Wong.
Yes. Interchangeable from what I understand.
Yes. It seems like a pretty big director. Mm-hmm. And I'm also to understand that this is film two in kind of a somewhat trilogy that he had.
Yeah, he has a, not an implied trilogy, but working with usual actors and things like that.
Right, right.
You know, to kind of create that little bit of connectivity to it.
So it's a drama romance. And let's just go back. Why did you go back to this 2000 movie? And how did you like it?
Well, this has been on my list forever, as a theme is with Ghost World. And then as well, Babel is on a list because I said it was on the list and then we didn't get to the list. Folks, Tom and I dog on Chinese market, the Chinese film market, quite a bit. We should. That international hand and international audience has a sway in some of the largest films today. But I don't want to be blind to Chinese filmmakers, as I pay attention to plenty of Japanese and Korean talent and always looking for more international directors. And that's kind of what lands us with Wong Kar-wai.
I'll say right off the bat, I don't know too much China work. Mm. Naturally, there's probably a stigma behind it because it's probably at some point it's just so heavily controlled and overlooked. But because this was 2000, was this proper China or was this Hong Kong filmmaking?
I think the separation, and I'm definitely a rookie when it comes to this, so this is an active kind of exploration.
We're learning together. Yeah,
you were learning. When it comes down to it, there's always a separation of Hong Kong film industry and then Chinese film.
Of course. Yes. Yeah.
And then Hong Kong, you get a lot of big stars and big directing
talent.
Pretty
democratized.
Yeah.
Well, before the events of the past few years and everything that went down in Hong Kong, it was always on the top list of business cities to do business in and economics
Absolutely.
And everything like that.
Absolutely.
Obviously, that's changed now. But this film, In the Mood for Love, and this director, is he Hong Kong productions or proper Chinese productions?
Hong Kong.
Okay. So not Shanghai.
And comes from a history of Hong Kong action as well.
Cool.
And that's where a lot of the starting seeds, the starting buds of what we'll see in Gung Fu. Big neo-noir stuff like Hard Boiled, Diving Through Doves, double pistols out. Those type of action movies are coming from Hong Kong at this time, or at least a little bit before the 90s.
Okay, cool. All right.
An area for interest for me. And again, despite us, whatever our commentary is worth on how international markets morph movies sometimes. Let's just take Chinese out of the picture.
Mm-hmm, sure.
How international movies or international markets will change and swap things out for bigger and bigger blockbuster releases. We talked about the international market perfect in the latter five Fast movies. I want to not be blind to filmmakers. And clearly this was this was an excellent movie.
Oh, good, good. Yeah. And just real quick, was it the movie that was on the list for a while or was it the director you wanted to hit for a while?
Actually, just this movie. Today, bringing us to Wong Kar-wai, the main films I'm interested in checking out are 1994's Chungking Express and then 2004's 2046. Either Chungking or 2046, one of those is part of this kind of suggested
trilogy. The 24 is the one with the number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 2406.
Yeah, I believe it's just because it shares the main actress. But this film, specifically, In the Mood for Love, why we jumped into this is that it is largely considered his best, a critical darling among the best of all time type of film lists that go about. All of these aspects are what kind of drove me to have some interest here for this film.
Very cool.
And just kind of jump into it, just see if I
liked
it.
I love it.
You know? In the Mood for Love is a straight romance that is set in a cramped Hong Kong apartment during the 1960s. It's kind of a throwback setting, which I think shows a lot of style for Wong Kar-wai. Our love interest is between Mr. Chow and Mrs. Chan. I promise that's real. I'm not being offensive with that. that really is the characters' names, but are married as they both move into the same tight apartment complex. What they share in common is that their spouses are increasingly absent from their lives, and they kind of find a bonding over this. The two of them begin to bond over specifically food in discussing this. Chow missing his wife's cooking and Chan not liking to cook for herself. And the romance is very subtle here. I would say this was the rare opportunity that I can call this a straight romance. Hmm. Not a rom-com.
Right.
Not really a rom-drom, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There is drama. But it is really a straight romance, which was interesting. And, you know, in kind of looking at the writing and looking at the story, not usually something I come across. I mean, even going to like a Fred Astaire, well, it's musical romance or musical romance comedy, you know.
Yeah.
There's these blendings. There's a pureness to this film and the romance that unfolds.
I mean, I like the sound of that because it is very rare to get that.
Exactly.
Even on our hundreds of films now. It's
right. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even think of one. You know, them bonding over this romance is very subtle. And I'll be honest, the language barrier doesn't help sometimes in picking up the chemistry. I think this is on the scale of novice to expert, you know, subtitle reader. This is going to be something that you need to be a little bit more engaged with and, you know, really lasered in to pick up everything.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But when it comes to that, it's the opposite of melodramatic. Their interaction is very toned back, even when things get emotionally intense. It's not something that's really like clocked up or over dramatic or anything like that. Slowly, things ramp up. And as they begin to kind of jokingly play and role play as each other's loved ones in kind of a playful way of pretending to get in fights or confronting them about them being missing in their lives, that turns into a dangerous game to play in love. And that's basically our setup for In the Mood for Love. Like I've said many times before, it is all about the execution. This may sound like a simple romance with an interesting time setting, but it is so much more when you're viewing this movie. Mm. And that's what I really want to kind of unpack here. Our setting is this tight apartment building with more communal space shown over private rooms even. That alone was kind of an interesting setting to unpack because not only is it so tight and claustrophobic, the way the space is shared and the gossipiness of, you know, who they're renting these apartments from, that was a fun factor to the film. They're both renting rooms from these overly nosy old people and they all live within this super tight unit. I mean, I don't know. I don't really have a respect for why that would be the living case in 1960s Hong Kong. And maybe it's just the work environment and they just need a place to live and stay with their work. But yeah, it was something else.
It's a cool environment to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Streets are these claustrophobic alleys lined with sweat and steam from food vendors. Everyone is just sweating all the time. So it's at least as good as Predator 2. I mean, if I could praise Predator 2 for the sweat, the prop sweat work here, it was pretty good. but I would almost call this a bit of noir, not for the story structure of how it's written, but just for the feel of noir. This 1960s Hong Kong has such a wonderful, dimly lit, cigarette-tinged feel to it that I got to say, I mean, like, Setting a romance like this back in the 60s, not that much. I feel like there's some serious vision in 2000 doing this kind of throwback setting to it. Yeah. And I enjoyed it a lot.
That's cool. And the busyness of it.
Yeah.
Kind of. I'm sure it felt very natural. I'm sure it didn't feel anything like
authentic.
You were in a movie studio.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure you weren't in a movie studio for almost all of it.
Right.
They just
right.
put them in there. I'm sure that sweat was real sweat, not prop sweat. Some guy with a spray bottle before they say
steam
action.
Steam coming off of the noodle vendor. yeah, it's like they're working hard. So.
But I like that. It's a little bit more raw. It's a little bit more real. And very cool.
I just was really, really all about the setting and the throwback of this and the intentionality of what that does to these claustrophobic spaces and how kind of relationships get mixed and tangled up.
Yeah, I guess the question I would have is, because we don't really know, probably, me and you don't know, how much did it feel like you were in the 60s in Hong Kong, or did it feel like maybe just it was the 2000s Hong Kong?
No, it definitely felt like we were in the 60s. Okay, okay. Yeah, for sure. I would say just primarily because of how they dress.
Sure,
I know what you mean, though, especially with some of the formal wear and whatnot. You know?
Formal wear, and some of those alleys probably look very similar throughout right, the decades, you right, know, the yeah, food vendors and everything like
the
that.
The steam's not getting any better. Yeah. Cinematography here is drop-dead gorgeous, folks. I mean, it's not very dynamic, but instead, it fixes itself, sometimes awkwardly distant from characters, and I'll kind of elaborate on that. We'll see characters through a mirror, or behind a lamp, or around a corner, and very rarely do we actually get up close and personal with our characters. And this is maintained throughout the entire film and is such a beautiful commitment to style. I mean, this is a drop-dead gorgeous film.
Wow.
I mean, really top-notch. I would call the camera style voyeuristic. I don't really like the term because there's the creepy overtone to voyeuristic, but it really is. We are kind of an onlooker. If anything, the gossipy neighbor in the apartment complex keeping tabs on, oh, they're hanging out. Mm. Oh, what's going on here? I'm telling you, it's such a wonderful match in what the concept of the romance is and how it plays out with our characters and what is shown to us through the visual language of the film. I mean, it is top notch.
Wow, very cool. Okay.
The biggest highlight for me is that, in fact, we see very little of their spouses in a brilliant move to make the audience feel the emotional distance in the relationship. We never see the spouses' faces.
Oh, really?
As this kind of, as the relationship flourishes. So this is where the movie evolves beyond just being good looking or me appreciating the style and it being cool. This is visual storytelling upon itself and visual storytelling for our characters. Mm. And that's where it's kind of cut from a whole different cloth for In the Mood for Love. But I stress to folks at home, even without the grass on that visual storytelling, even if you say, I couldn't care less about, you know, what is going on with there, the beauty of the film is why I would recommend it so highly. And I feel like how that plays into how our characters are portrayed, them sitting down at a diner and us not being in front of them. Instead viewing it from, you know, a good bit back.
Interesting, yeah.
There is a quality there that it translates to a different feel in the romance. If anything, like I said, with the subtitling, kind of that's where it's hard to grasp sometimes.
I can also only imagine that, you know, subtitles are not a difficult thing to get right.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can see it, if it's being shot like that, where you're with the old woman or something like that, you're back a few rows at the diner or something like that. You sitting on your couch being like, get me closer. You know what I mean?
Right.
Get me more closer to that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Shot-wise almost, but that's very cool. That's very cool that it works.
And believe me, it's not just a gimmick. The commitment is fall through to the entire film. It's so much so that we never see the faces of the you know, the missing spouses, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very cool.
Yeah.
And very purposeful. It's very, that fits the story too. Yeah. These characters longing for their spouses a little bit.
Absolutely.
Taking a big absence in their life. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah. I was just really stunned with it. Coming off of it being so purposeful and so intentional. I mean, it was a breath of fresh air for the week, especially, you know, coming off of what we're coming off. I love actually this week in context bookending the fast.
It is a big difference. A big difference.
I would say my only critique is soundtrack. It could use a little bit more love. It's not that it's bad, but there's only about like two or three songs that are repeated.
Mm.
One song with some plucking violins is repeated a little bit ad nauseum as well. And I'll be just kind of straight up about it. It gets a little bit annoying. I feel like just some variety could be used.
Oh, okay.
Possibly this was a budget constraint. I don't know, though. With how much intentionality is in the film, maybe there was a purposefulness of it being playing again. But real talk, it was a tiny bit annoying, and just with two or three songs, there's just a little bit too much repeat, if you ask me.
Okay.
So, beyond that, though, it is a deceivingly great film. I thought it was going to be okay. I didn't know, honestly, how I was going to feel about the romance, but it really surprised me. Folks, if you like a little bit more of a melancholy romance like Eternal Sunshine or maybe Lost in Translation, I would say this would be a great watch, as intimidating as going into Hong Kong cinema may be. But for my beginning exploration of that Hong Kong cinema, this was a knockout. This film and the filmmaking on display here reminds me of the purposefulness you find in a director like Kubrick. And that's about as high as a recommendation that I can give.
Yeah.
We're going to go ahead and give In the Mood for Love 2000 and 82.
Wow. Yay. We're in the 82s. Okay.
it's been a minute.
Really good, Vin. Wow. I'm happy that you.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that it was on your list for a while and it was just kind of like there.
Absolutely.
Wow. 82%, really good. Absolutely. And this made it through. It's actually funny that we're kind of bringing up Cannes Film Festival just kind of came to an end.
Oh, yeah.
Over the past weekend. Mm-hmm. And this did pretty well at Cannes, actually. Mm. This won 2 awards. He won award for Best Actor, I believe.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of cool. Definitely did well, and it did well in the Chinese markets as well, as far as like awards and reception and everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, 82%, really good, Vin. Would have never found this one.
For sure. And I'm right there with you. And why, you know, hopefully we can go into some of other Wong Kar-wai's works and other kind of Hong Kong stuff.
Hong Kong, I would love to go into Hong Kong stuff a little bit.
I mean, good action is there.
Yeah.
You know? So, again, hard-boiled is something that I've never seen. So, you know, and that's a very, very famous, you know, kind of, the birth of gun film.
Yeah, very cool. Okay. All right, so In the Mood for Love, 82%. Original title.
Oh, boy.
Fei Yong Ninhua.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
We'll give a brownie point for trying. I love that you're always trying.
Okay, so moving on. Another film that wasn't quite, you know, again, not on my radar that much. It was fun to do some research on this one. This is in 2001. This is starring a very young Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah.
This is called Ghost World, kind of now this is more of a comedy-based, comedy drama.
Yep, yep.
And let's just get into it right away. Again, why did you pick Ghost World, and how was it?
Yeah, a super random pick off my list, and that list just never stops growing, you know.
Especially, I love it.
Since the podcast, people are constantly recommending me movies, and I'm very open about just throwing it on the list and seeing if I ever get to it, honestly. So
I'm less open. The funny thing is when people tell me to tell you to watch something, it's just, he's got a lot to watch here.
He's got a lot. I have no experience with this director, and he really doesn't have a huge amount of filmography to cross paths with. Honestly, I'm really not sure how it landed on my radar in the first place. I think, like you said, an early Scarlett Johansson. This is pre Lost in Translation.
Was it the same year? Was Lost in Translation 2001 as well?
No, 2003. So this being 2001, so this is even earlier.
She's a child.
Yeah, she has such a deep voice back then too. Like it's,
I know, it's weird. She always has appeared a little bit older than what she really is.
Right,
but she is still, this is a child.
Yeah, and this is quite the revered movie critically. So you only kind of chop down a list by watching it. You know, I mean, that's kind of been my logic with getting through the list. It's not getting any better with the franchise episodes that I really do love doing those franchise episodes, but I just kind of tackle movies.
Yeah, taking a step back.
You know?
And we are kind of like High Fidelity, Sideways.
Sure.
There was another one in there I kind of forget, honestly.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun tackling these early 2000s.
Yeah.
Kind of that have a bit of a cult following now, which this does have.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think that's a great read because it's very similarly to those movies. Well, they're very highly revered as far as critically online.
Yeah, you know? Big time.
Big scores around this, so.
This was nominated for an Oscar for the adapted screenplay.
Oh, really? Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. So, in Ghost World, two offbeat best friends have just graduated high school with zero plans and zero entailed for their lives. Enid is played by Thora Birch from Hocus Pocus fame, and Rebecca is played by Scarlett Johansson in a extremely early role in her career. I mean, the same goes for Thora Birch, but obviously Scarlett Johansson has a lot more staying power with her stardom. Both of them are these too cool for life, jaded teenage girls, hipster weirdos, and generally think real life is lame. Out of this sheer boredom, they start messing around with a lonely man played by Steve Buscemi, only to find out he's kind of their type of weirdo. What kind of plays out from here is a dark comedy romance that is raunchier than you think and tries to kind of shock you a bit in what comes out of these girls' mouths. That's kind of the focus for the duration of the film. The writing, I would say, is the biggest highlight, despite a kind of a slow, awkward pace to the film. On the surface, I just kind of assumed that this would be a proto version of Superbad or even like an edgier Hughes-style party destination film.
Yeah.
It's not that, though. There's no party destination. They're not trying to, you know, get, you know, a race to the last party of their high school career or anything like that. So it separates itself from that, and in a good way. I feel like it's a lot more unique for that reason. I was way wrong. I honestly can't compare this to too many things. The closest thing I have in kind of the tone of how characters are just kind of languishing in the town itself, the ghost world, if you will.
Right,
it's like a Juno from 2007.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's the closest thing, but it's been a while since I've seen Juno, so.
Yeah, because this is, even though it's billed as a comedy, it also has that drama in there, right? So it's not like, you're not getting gut laughs here. It's an hour and 51. It's rated R. You're kind of just living this weird period with these girls' lives.
Yes, definitely like a hangout type of movie.
Yeah. Juno, I bet Juno kind of captures that weird feeling you get, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. Because it's not like a pregnancy scare type of story or anything
No,
that.
But a vibe.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of. Yeah.
That's the closest vibe I can get. but the way the cynical dark comedy plays out, it's very slow as it's combined with almost a day in the life type of structure of this lame, dying town. Admittedly, that makes the ramp up of this first 30 minutes feel a bit aimless, but I would say stick with it because it's a pretty unique film. I do wish more time was split evenly with our two leads. They're both weirdos in their own way, but things lean so heavily on Birch's character. It doesn't help that the dramatic tension that comes from the character is almost always directly her fault as well. Like it's kind of a hard protagonist to get behind. You know, it's a frustrating protagonist.
Right. Yeah, sure.
But I think the whole movie just would have been so much better by balancing things out a little bit with Johansson more, not to mention the star power she has on screen, young or not. I felt like every time that she was on screen, I was just so interested in her raspy, dark voice and delivering these, you know, these kind of dark comedy lines. It was such a good match. I just wish there was more there, of a balancing act then. Like I said, it's been forever since I've seen something similar to the vibes of 2007's Juno, but Ghost World, the name, it comes from how the town has just a host of bit characters that just linger in the setting. That is the ghost world, and that is the point of this post-graduation kind of blues that these characters have, which I think is enjoyable for a lot of the movie. It's just that the ramp up feels a little bit aimless, and then the ramp down is just, I don't know. It's not exactly satisfying.
Sure, not a big payoff to it. You know, it was directed. It was based off a comic book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I almost wonder it would be like this. This sounds very. This could easily be an anime story.
Yeah, for sure.
Right, two girls just graduated, meandering around some obscure city, almost.
Yep, absolutely.
But yeah, originally a comic book, which is kind of funny.
Yeah. And really, just this whole point of this small town blues, that is the focus of these characters. That's the focus of the characters they interact with, and kind of the point of the whole film. So, overall, I thought it was an okay film. Things hit a good stride in that middle third of the film, but it's bookended by a slow ramp up and kind of an unsatisfying ramp down. I'll give it a soft recommendation for the writing strength and how original the concept is, but otherwise, I felt it was just good to knock off the list. We're going to go ahead and give Ghost World 2001 a 63.
63, wow, okay. And also, would you say maybe if you're interested in a ScarJo, like an early ScarJo performance,
absolutely,
just to check it out kind of deal?
Because what she is there, I mean, it's interesting. It's because you even look at like 2003's Lost in Translation, it's a very laid-back role. She's slinging some funny lines here.
Yeah.
She's showing comedy chops, which, again, you know, I mean, it's so early in the career.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's almost, I bet you kind of, 63, a little lackluster for how much praise it gets.
Right, right.
I mean,
considering, I think Metacritic, this is in the 90s or something like that.
Roger Ebert gave it 4 out of 4 stars.
Right.
Which, you know, we shit on a lot of aggregators and critics, but yeah, we both have respect for Ebert.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
Interesting. Okay, 63%. All right. Okay, so let's move on. This is now 2006. We're going on with our Inarritu study.
Right.
And
that's the ghost world.
This is
where was the study?
That's okay. I like it. I like it.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is Cate Blanchett. This is Brad Pitt. It's rated R. It's 2 hours and 23 minutes. This is Babel. I remember there was a lot of talk when this came out, even though Inarritu's name wasn't much of anything.
Right, right.
But you had these two big stars.
Yeah.
Definitely a weirder film. And I remember even the trailer being weird.
Yes, yes.
I saw this like 10 years ago.
Really?
Uh-huh, yeah. I don't know. I kind of enjoyed it. It was weird, but let's get right into it. How was kind of very early? This is pre-2010 Inarritu.
Yep.
How do we like it?
I really did like this film. It's not the heights of what I've been finding with Amores Perros and 21 Grams.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I was enjoying this film just because he's able to tackle so much of an interconnected story. He really, really tries to go after these complicated juggling acts early in his career. So, but yeah, it may not feel like we're keeping up with Iñárritu as a director, but I assure you he's never left my sights. We got two movies left, this in 2006 and then Beautiful from 2010. And after that, we will have every movie of Iñárritu rated and on the website, which is such a great feeling, especially for such a great, you know, legitimately great director.
Yeah. We both really enjoy him.
Yeah. Some top-notch stuff.
Yep, he does great stuff. We're finding that in his, he does have, he's can be weird and out there.
Yeah.
But correct me if I'm wrong, we're finding about his DNA a little bit.
It's
time-based, right?
It is.
And story overlaying, kind of?
Yeah.
Is that right?
It's odd because, I mean, coming into this, my initial ideas of what I thought his trademark would be the surrealist dream sequences. You look at Birdman, you look at Revenant,
you look at
Bardo. The dream sequences define those experiences.
I would push back on Revenant, but yes.
Sure. But we're connected with his wife and whatnot.
For sure.
A driving factor for the character. I got to tell you, I mean, not for his early career. I'm dead wrong, you know. Maybe it's not black and white, one-trick pony kind of thing. You know, those later ones are the ones he writes. So maybe that's what he's concerned with in his own writing. These earlier ones, though, it is undeniable that he has these heavily interlocked stories early in his career. Amores Perros has the three characters and three character chapters. 21 Grams having three characters, but their stories being shuffled about through the editing.
Yeah.
Here with Babel, there is an increase in focal points from three to four stories, which we'll get into. I feel like that's actually kind of a misstep for the film. And the style of those stories are wildly different, with the editing cutting between them. Wildly, wildly different.
Okay.
The feeling of these stories. Just how we described with 21 Grams, the lanes of the story, this has four layers to the story. They're not really lanes, and they tie together in weird, wide, and vast ways. We jump around to each of these four layers every 3 minutes or so, like clockwork, which is an interesting and honestly, sometimes frustrating choice, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, because it's not like it's a short movie.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of jumping.
It's a lot of jumping, and then also when they decide to cut it off, sometimes at the most climactic, sometimes at almost cliffhanger-ish type of editing of, what's going to happen? And we snap to such a different genre that it can be really jarring. And I feel like that's where distinctly this kind of falls lower in execution from the heights of certainly the editing in 21 Grams, where that was just such a thought through type of jigsaw puzzle that he put together.
It was really good flow.
Yeah.
Still jumping all over the place.
Right.
But it flowed together really well.
Right. It was something that you puzzled together. Here, you're just kind of waiting to get back to the one you care about most, almost like an anthology of short films.
I mean, this is what we talk about always. When you set up a story like this and you have multiple storylines going, naturally, there's going to be a hierarchy of like to dislike.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. What's best out of it? You have a ranking. And I feel like that's anyone's experience with these type of films.
That's how it's going to be. Like when you, which we talked about it, with the Fate of the Furious. Not the Fate of the Furious, the Saga one.
Yeah, F9 and F10.
Right. Naturally, you got six out of six storylines.
You probably work. Some don't.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just naturally going to happen, though, in a movie like this.
Yeah, very true. Very true. I also love the tie back to Fast and Furious.
anything we can do.
Folks, we're keeping it up as long as we can, because it is definitely a fever dream in my head. I can't stress enough, though, as intimidating as these four layers are, the execution is excellent. The show of range for Iñárritu to juggle all these different genres is incredible. Is it a great pill to swallow? No. But it is impressive in how each of these four stories on their own work very well and are just show range that he hasn't tackled before.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I was in love with each of these, and even though the blending is a little bit jarring, I feel like it's still landing very positive for me because each of the individual components was so good. But let me do a quick breakdown of each of these we got. four stories. So rapid fire. Story A focuses on a Moroccan goat herder family, specifically on their two sons. And while they're playing around during their chores, a simple but very unfortunate accident turns into a very intense crime investigation in Morocco, no less. So I don't know. I don't know how that law system works, if I'm being honest. It's very intense, and intense is exactly what I would describe both this and story B. You know, it's coming-of-age drama with a heavy focus on ethics, which I feel like in the innocence of these two Moroccan kids, it was a great story to see unfold. Story B gives us some star power, as both Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett are vacationing in the same Moroccan setting. On their vacation, yeah, I feel like they kind of wasted both of them in one. You know what I mean? They couldn't split them apart. You know, give some variety.
They were the big. I remember when this came out. They were the big draw, yep. Especially for an American audience.
Oh, sure.
Obviously, they're going to be the ones in the commercials.
Yep. Yep.
They were definitely the big draw.
Yeah.
I remember watching it then. Like, came out in 2006. I think this was a Netflix watch, like an early kind of Netflix watch for me. Mm-hmm. The patience back then of me, I was just like, get back. Can we get back to the people I know?
Yo, for sure.
You know what
sure.
I mean?
But that's a real experience, too.
Yes,
I don't think that's invalid, you know?
I would love to return to this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited that you really was pleased that you did this one.
Yeah, absolutely. This vacation goes horribly wrong and focuses on more of how our fellow man will go to, how far they will go to help someone in need, despite cultural boundaries. This is even more intense and incredibly jarring when we snap to it at points in the film. And despite us holding our two big star actors in this, you know, story B segment, it was probably my least favorite segment for this reason. I feel like if there was ever a point that I was actually turned off from the editing and the layering of the story, it was when we were snapping here. Despite a good performance from Cate Blanchett and Brad Pitt, I love them. I like their characters. I like the individual story, but this was a hard one to snap back to, especially after any degree of lightheartedness. It's very, very intense.
Okay.
So,
interesting.
We're halfway through. Story C takes a much lighter turn as Brad Pitt's Mexican nanny has to figure out how to attend her only son's wedding while dealing with her obligations to the kids she takes care of. We go on a kind of a semi-fun adventure in taking the kids to this wedding across Mexican borders, and experiencing a feeling of equal parts wonder and a little bit of fear through the children's eyes. Against all odds, this was my favorite segment, because it was just so genuinely sweet at times and heart-filled with it. It felt like really, really genuine in a way that I think Iñárritu could only capture, especially around Mexican culture. This gave me a little bit of flashbacks of Bardo as well, just how true to that culture it felt.
Okay.
In critical and also kind of a love lover. This also includes Gael Garcia Bernal, who was our lead in Amores Perros.
That's my boy.
That's your new boy.
Yeah, well, he's been my boy for a bit. We talked about it last time in Amores Perros.
Okay. And a very young Ellie Fanny as well. I'm now baby young. So also single-handedly is a better look at Spanish family culture than 10 Fast and Furious films altogether. So I'll take that for what it's worth. And finally, we get story D, following a probably in the biggest turn of this genre and subject matter, a Japanese teenage deaf girl attempting to live a normal life in Tokyo. The biggest feature here is what Iñárritu is able to create in the feeling of how the teenage experience is warped from her deafness. And this is what I mean, that these segments on their own capture a great short film, a great episodic type of feeling.
Of course, yep.
But if anything for this last fourth segment, that's what I mean, that a move to 3 to 4 kind of leaves it lopsided. Definitely feels the weakest as well as far as connective tissue.
I mean, talk about lopsided, because you're really in the same location for the most part.
Right.
At least the feel.
We talked about last week,
the whole vibe is kind of there.
Yeah.
And to do a 180 completely.
Right, into
Deaf Girl Tokyo.
But also like teenage, like J-pop cafes. Like it feels
distinctly very jarring.
Different. Yeah. Positives for getting my girl, Rinko Kikuchi, from Pacific Rim, which I was surprised to see in here.
And was she also, was she one of the, playing the many characters in, of course, our great movie
Oh, you're going to mention it.
I am going to mention it. We've gone so many.
I'm not going to give it to you.
Claude Atlas. She is, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think she's one of them. I have a Claude Atlas note coming up.
Oh, really? Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, anything that's anthology, I'll mention Claude Atlas. Yeah. But it's a bit shocking as the characters in this segment, I mean, I'll come right out and say they're very horny. It's a little off-putting in its sexuality as well, and not in a prudish kind of way, but you know, identical to story B, this has its own jarring effect in its own right. Now, let me take a half second for breath, but that's our four right there. It is something else. Does that make sense as far as the structure? And even maybe what
I mean,
you remember.
It's a lot going on, but really, three of those four stories are as different as they are, very similar. I don't know. You're on location. It's got the same kind of feel to it, even mm-hmm. though you have tragic, you have weird stuff going on with the law in this one, mm-hmm. and you have this, like, the kids having a good time or whatever. It's all playing around in the same pool, mm-hmm. you know, to be taking that jump in that fourth one. It just sounds jarring.
Yeah.
You know, I know he loves to connect things in crazy ways. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that happens. And I'm no spoilers. I know.
I don't
remember
eventually.
This film that much. Right.
I mean, it's just a very big juggling act for this movie. Yes, it's bold, but I feel like it will lose a lot of viewers in how drastic the switches are. Don't get me wrong. Like we mentioned, 21 grams, very intense editing style that honestly demanded that you pay close attention to it for the literal jigsaw puzzle of putting together the story, but it never switched in tone and genre. It was always this heavy, dramatic story with all three characters that we focused on. Here with Babel, if only for story D, the Japanese deaf girl story, it just, the switch feels too drastic.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Amores Perros, mm-hmm. I mean, that was very intense as well, too, right?
Intense visually and content matter.
Right, okay, yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong, 21 grams, absolutely as well, but I feel like the defining is just how we're consuming the story through that editing. I really think it's the case that the fourth story is just one step too far to, not a template, because he's not writing these himself, but clearly a story that he wants to go after. You can even feel it in the summary of them. We go from Moroccan family connected to the Moroccan vacation. That vacation is connected to a nanny back home, and then the connection somewhere in the midst of that is a Japanese deaf girl. it's going to kind of just lose you. The stories will tie together eventually in the film, but as a viewer, we wait much longer for that final fourth to come into scope, and it's just, I imagine it loses people. And it will lose people. So, you know, viewer beware. Mm-hmm. you already mentioned it, but this gives me a chance to bring up 2012's Claude Atlas. as I think that's a better viewing experience. Experience these as, I mean, try your best maybe not to see them as interconnected until that is evident to the viewer. View them as just kind of a weird layering of this anthology, these short stories that
tie
together.
So you brought up Claude Atlas not because of the girl.
No, I brought it because of the structure.
I haven't brought it up in like 40 episodes.
I'm telling you. You're reading my mind. He's Professor X over here. But yeah. one overlap that I maybe notice is that there are cops involved in each of these. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's like a kind of like a crime anthology. Because there is a definitive role that cops play in each one of these.
Any dogs? In this one?
No dogs.
Okay.
Maybe. No dogs.
Okay.
Why do you?
That was our working theory. Oh. Amores Perros and 21 Grams.
Oh.
A big dog.
Dog through movies.
Line. Right? They were dog through lines.
I don't know. I'm telling you what.
I don't know.
This is probably the least successful trademark study of. I mean, I'm usually pretty good with this one.
You don't remember the dog through lines?
Oh, of course. But
for both of them, right?
Yeah, but no dogs here.
Okay. No, I get it. I'm just asking.
Just tracking the dogs.
That's it. You know, it's been a while since we've, you know, heard from Inarritu.
For real. Yeah. Maybe I should throw out the crime anthology because it's been a while for me as well. That seems like a stab in the dark.
No, but I'd like it though.
Yeah. But my judge on all of these, much like any kind of short film anthology, is that is the individual quality good? And I would say yes, that is the case here. You know, Inarritu excels in his directing. However, it's just a very awkwardly shaped pill to swallow. And I think that's what really separates apples to apples, the same type of quality of his filmmaking and why it falls lower specifically of everything we've covered so far. Even stuff that we haven't put recording
wow.
to.
Okay.
So, despite the editor, Stephen Mirioni? How do you pronounce
it? Yeah, Mirione. Yeah. And Douglas Kreiss as well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's Stephen's working on nearly all of Iñárritu's films. I feel a little bit more love was put into the layering of the stories better and executed upon much better in the previous works, and really could have helped this reach the heights of the films that we covered so far.
Okay.
We're going to go ahead and give Babel 2006 a 69.
Okay, so 69, not terrible.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know, you're jumping around a lot. You said like every 3 minutes kind of you're jumping stories.
Yeah, almost like a rule.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you get back to your story, mm-hmm. does it pick up right away or there's a lot of time lapse?
That's a good question. I think mostly right away, actually.
Like I wonder if I were to go and chop up these things mm-hmm. and make individual short
sure,
films.
Sure, re-edit them.
How would they flow? You know what I mean?
Think it picks up pretty much right away. Maybe a little bit of time gap.
Could almost be even more kind of annoying.
Exactly.
Like, just let me watch it.
Because there's no yeah. kind of running timeline or anything like that.
Right,
you
right.
know, we it's almost like, well, I've kind of wasted the time and I'm back where I started. You don't feel like these characters are operating independently in the edit. So,
interesting.
But, yeah, I mean, I think where this falls short is in how awkward it is to experience. It's not bad, but that's why it didn't crack 70s for sure.
Okay. So. Yeah, 69, not a bad score.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So that was Babel with the 69%. I'm still curious. I think I might want to go back and watch this.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to move on. I was a little bit confused of the release with this next.
It was my first note. What's going on with this one?
Okay, good. I think I figured it out for the most part
okay.
because basically this is a 2002 release.
2022.
What is it, 2002?
Yeah,
this is a 2022 release
yep.
in Scandinavia.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then
Lionsgate gets it
because it also was, there were producers that were attached to John Wick.
Just Lionsgate. But in the marketing, they were really tying this on the back of John
Wick. Of John
Wick. Coming in.
That's the only time I saw the trailer for this
yep.
was before John Wick.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, because I thought there was something on the title saying from the something of John Wick.
Studio. But
was that right?
That's
okay.
all it is. Yeah.
Yeah, it actually got an applause from
oh.
my audience watching.
Oh, really? Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So this film, so it's a 22, anyway, it's a 22 release,
yep.
even though it's just came out in April in theaters.
Yes.
You might even be able to see it in small-time theaters
yeah,
still. Or
yeah.
It gets picked up by those secondary theaters, mm-hmm. kind of. Anyway, this is called Sisu. It's by a director named Jalamari Hallander, which we haven't...
Finnish name, right, for sure.
Who we haven't dealt with before,
oh, no.
obviously. And it's ultra gory. There's a reason why they're tying this to John Wick.
Yeah.
So let's get into it a little bit. What are the connections to John Wick? What separates it? And overall, how did you like it?
Sure, sure. So I was definitely craving, believe it or not, more action coming off the Fast Week.
Good action.
Right. The itch that can't get scratched.
Right.
10 movies later. Yeah. I mean, this was something that I wanted to check out a few weeks back, but just it did not make the cut. And if anything, all coming off of, you know, the publicity with John Wick.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Written and directed by the relative newcomer, Finnish creator, Jalmar is it Hallander?
Yeah. Hallander. Yep.
Hallander.
Jamal. Yeah. Jalmari yeah. Hallander, yep.
And being a Finnish director, I do not have any experience in films where he's covered otherwise.
I'll tell you, we're globetrotting on this one.
We are, yeah. This is jet set. This being a watch this week, because again, I was kind of having that lingering itch for action. This came out earlier in the year with the release John Wick 4 and marketed like a World War II Wick-like action
mm-hmm.
film.
Yeah.
But really, the only connection here is just Lionsgate as the studio, you know, just trying to go off the back of the hype train that was Wick 4. This is definitely heavily inspired by Hallander as a director, has spoken very lovingly over what John Wick has done for his writing style
okay.
and what he wanted to capture here. So this is 100% inspired directly by John Wick and entering into that long list of copycat movies, which I won't go over again. We'll have to have a form on the website of the Wick copycats.
Arguably, like some of them were really step downs. This one, at least, it looked it looked visually appealing.
Yeah.
And it looked like it maybe had some punch to it.
Yeah, I think World War II, cool setting for an action piece of this style.
Yeah.
You're dealing with some different challenges, you know, if you think of what an action hero has to go up against,
right.
These are actually, you know, tanks and military stuff. So as the opening credits will explain, Sisu is a difficult Finnish word to translate, roughly describing a stoic badass who will take down anything and any challenge. Our Sisu is a Finnish man played by Jorma Tomila. That finds a huge gold deposit in 1944, far into Nazi territory. And I mean huge. It's a lot of gold. he doesn't speak a single word, but we know he will have to go through hell to get his gold home. And that's basically our setup. It's honestly, my early praise of this, it is dead simple. And that's a good thing.
It's good.
It's a straight line, basically.
Mm-hmm. It's an hour and a half, too.
Yeah. And if we talk about, I mean, you go back to that Wick episode, my praise of it doesn't need to be overcomplicated. If anything, John Wick 2 and 3, when it gets messy, is when they start, you know, glow hopping.
Absolutely.
This straightforwardness of the film was definitely a strength here. The Nazis are super cartoonish in how evil they are, but a lot of fun. Sure, in the Inglorious Bastards camp of depicting them as evil as possible, which is great. And I'll circle back to it, but the movie feels like a direct combination of Wick-style action with some Tarantino flair. Like a 100%, like 50-50 baby.
Man, that's not...
Yeah, that's...
It's kind of what it looked like, too.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it had that Tarantino look to it in all the good ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The movie is a short, snappy 90 minutes, and that is... folks, that is what Papa ordered. That is what Vin needed. I'll tell you what, after watching... There's so many unneeded, unnecessarily long films.
Yeah, yeah.
The one coming up with Little Mermaid is included in that. So, and it plays out even shorter in chapters that are pretty rapid fire. The chapter structure is fun, though, and almost video gamey and pulling from those same 70s trope that Tarantino does. So I really appreciate the simplicity. Having a straightforward destination for an action plot is sometimes all that you need. Guy gets gold. He's got to get through gold through Nazis. That's the setup here. That's
right,
Sisu.
Right.
So, but let's talk about that action itself, because I think it's really the where I'm calling heads or tails on the whole movie, and that's where it all really matters. Some serious gore here, much more than I expected. I mean, really clocked up. I would say take the R rating very seriously here. There is a chapter called The Minefield, and folks, it earns its title. So, not a kid watch. Hand-to-hand action choreography is much slower than expected. Most likely to compensate for Tomila's real life age, you know, being an old dude.
Mm.
I can't say he's lacking physically, though, because this old guy is ripped. I mean, he is jacked. More often than not, we see fight scenes play out as kind of a stage speed, and I was just looking for maybe a little bit more viciousness. I was looking for a little bit more electricity to these fight scenes, where it does seem a little bit more staged. You know, they're kind of, you know, waiting
sure.
for the punch, if you will.
Sure, yeah, so. The choreography isn't quite as snappy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Where I get into the critique of... you know, of that action itself, is that all the edits and the cuts are wrong. This may look like a Wick-style action film, but the feel of the action is all wrong. The vibe. that's today's episode. Word of the episode.
Word of the week.
Yeah. You can see this perfectly in any close quarters fight scene, a back of a truck, on a plane, etc., because the camera placement, choreography, and most of all, editing makes fights very choppy.
Hmm.
If anything, I would compare this directly to 2021's Nobody, where even with more of a Wick comparison, the action feels all wrong. And that's where it matters most, honestly. That's
for a film like this, absolutely. Yeah. It's kind of surprising to hear, honestly.
Yeah. I felt identical. I mean, Nobody was basically carbon copy, and I kind of ripped it, you know, on that alone. But action is where... things are falling short. We have Wick imitators, but no one does Wick like Chad Stahelski.
Yeah, and I'm okay. Like, if the action is going to be a little bit different, I'm okay with that. One, I don't know, because you're dealing with an older main character, but you're also in World War II.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So if the action is going to be different, and slower but more brutal,
yep,
you know, that kind of makes sense. But mm-hmm. if what you're saying is that the actual editing behind it, mm-hmm. or cinematographer behind it, is lacking or making it worse, mm-hmm. you know, that's what pulls you out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't want to rip into this too much because he is a younger director, and more of a rookie here, and clearly is now doing a feature that plays to his style, what he likes to watch. You know, he has a love letter to John Wick.
Yeah.
So I would say that's where it kind of falls short a little bit. Tomila is good as this grizzled old man, but he's put in a few too many ridiculous action sequences. Like, when this film is gritty, when it's up close, when it's showing that great gore, that's when it works. But when larger set pieces are brought in, that's where it was honestly losing my attention a little bit. Don't get me wrong, there are some very wild action sequences here, again, tied to the fun of making these chapters, but if anything, it's closer than the Fast movies than you think. I promise. After this episode, I'll drop all the Fast and Furious references. Oh, man. But they really sap the film of some stakes more often than not. Like, you see him get out of the impossible, but especially when that ties into just more and more impossible stuff. I mean, I feel like that's these set pieces kind of hurt that real mm-hmm, gritty mm-hmm, action sure. that is equally a praise for it. So overall, I would say the film is largely an imitator that is missing some of the secret sauce of what it's trying to copy. But at the same time, that's not a terrible thing. I think that's not a terrible thing for the director. I think that's not a terrible thing for any audience that is to Lionsgate's marketing,
yep.
craving more John Wick style action. You know, if you love the idea of a love child between Wick and Tarantino, if that sounds good to you, well, guess what? You got to watch here. So I feel a little bad because Hollander is a new director and stated how much of a positive influence John Wick has had on his filmmaking. But there is a key misunderstanding that all of these copycats make, and that is Chad Stahelski is a stunt choreographer first and a director second.
Mm.
We're going to go ahead and give Sisu a 64.
Okay, 64. I think that's a great. The way you ended it, it's that perfect. Not for everybody. Here's who it really is right. for. And maybe give it a watch.
Yeah. And watch that rated R because it was a little shocking. Good, but, you know, shocking.
Yeah, that's one thing. Not that John Wick doesn't have blood and everything like that.
Right.
For how much action and killing it has,
right.
It's much more safer than maybe you think.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah. Okay, so Sisu with a 64%. All right. Very, very good, Vin. All right, folks, and with that, we are going to go ahead into our producer segment here. So, Ben, we do have a producer coming in today, coming in with a Space Odyssey donation, so 2001 pennies, and we have Isaac Garcia coming in, and Isaac writes, came here via the NA show.
Oh.
No agenda donation here.
Look at that.
My first listen was the John Wick pod. I love y'all's passion for movie detail and truly enjoyed the John Wick episode.
Oh, that's great.
The Scorsese Godshot sequence homage was my favorite scene in John Wick 4. Scanning the website, I sense deep respect for Michael Mann.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, my God.
Parentheses, he's God.
No, absolutely.
Keep up the good work, and I look forward to back listening to other episodes.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Yeah, Isaac, thank you so much, dude.
Also, also coming off of all the John Wick talking as well.
It's so perfect. It's perfect. And as we put in the newsletter this week, folks, if you saw, which Isaac, get ready, John Wick 5 is announced, and it's in early development.
There it is.
I don't know if that'll make you happy or sad, but everyone had questions coming out of it. Is it going to be? Is it not going to be?
Yeah.
Keanu Reeves didn't even know. Stahelski didn't even know.
Oh, really?
It's settled now. Lionsgate said it. John Wick 5 is going to be in production.
There it is.
So
never
get
stops.
Ready. Isaac Garcia, thank you so much, man. You are the executive producer of 85. You are producer of the Daily Ratings. Thank you for coming over. Hey, you heard the shout out, no agenda. And that's awesome, man. We're glad you like it. You said you're going to. Careful when you do the back listening.
We're always nervous about this.
I get nervous, you know. Once when you hit below 30, maybe the value starts to drop off a little bit. You know, we're getting used to the mics a little bit still. But thank you so much for producing this episode, Isaac. We really appreciate it. He sent an email saying in case the PayPal note got cut off that he emailed us.
Okay.
And it did. So, Isaac, I don't know what you saw on your end. You must have got some sort of feeling that didn't go through right. Vin and I, the best, you know, we can kind of complain a whole lot about our the way the donation stuff is set up on the back end. The one good thing is you're supposed to be able to write as long as a note that you want.
Sure.
You have that comment section. You can expand that for as long as you want. So I don't know what happened on your side, Isaac. Hopefully not many other people are going to have an issue with it.
Yeah, and also what you did as far as following up over email, phenomenal.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we want.
And that's why I brought it up too. So folks, if you feel like your note got cut off or whatever, once when you send in your donation in, if just in case you've sent something kind of, tom.fan@thedailyratings.
Absolutely.
Just go ahead and send it our way.
Absolutely. Handle that perfectly. I'll try to get some Michael Mann movies. I mean, I can get down with so much of Michael Mann. Would love to, in the floating ideas of what we're going to do for the upper end of scores and specials, would love to do a deep dive on Heat, which is one of my all-time favorites.
I mean, yeah, we're definitely playing around with what we want to do with those 90s and ups, because it's so rare for the daily ratings to be in the 90s that we might want to highlight those movies in a kind of a different way.
Absolutely.
And Heat is like, you know, it's Heat. It's fantastic. again, so hey, folks, if you want to be a producer just like Isaac, you go to thedailyratings.com, you go to the donations tab, and you go ahead and give us some monetary support. You go ahead and fill out your donation form, and it's any amount you want to send our way. Isaac sent in, it's a one-time donation called the Space Odyssey Donations, 2,001 pennies, otherwise known as $20.01. but you can also do a value-for-value payment. So the idea for that is, are you getting value from what Vin and I are doing here on the podcast, on the website, with the newsletter? Are you enjoying it? Is this curating kind of a movie list for you? Are we making you laugh? Are we kind of getting you into movies more than what you were a year ago? If so, if you're finding that value in your life, that's what it's all about. You go to the donations tab on the daily ratings, and then through monetary support, you just send us back some value. It is value for value. So, Isaac, thank you so much. You obviously gotten some value. You started listening on John Wick episode. You're already a producer. Very, very cool. Another way to produce right now in our early stages, this is episode 85, tell somebody about
it.
Get our name out there. We want to be in the conversation. If you can, get us in the conversation. We thank you all so, so much. All right, Vin. So with that, we're going to keep it going. This is the big release of the week. This is our in theaters now. This is The Little Mermaid by Rob Marshall. a lot of chit-chat about this film. Let's just get into it.
Sure.
What's the good? What's the bad? And what's the wet ugly?
Ugly. the under the sea muck. Folks, I'll be honest here. I don't know if it'll be the most exciting review on this one, but I'll try my best. What I would like to start, though, with is a breakdown. I kind of broke this down a little bit for a Pinocchio review. I feel like I want to reiterate it here because Little Mermaid is a huge, huge IP to get this treatment, this remake treatment.
Yes.
Disney has a handful of templates they go off of. I think four templates from my kind of judgment of it. Disney has their animation in-house that basically chases their in-house sister studio Pixar for animated features. They have their continuing efforts to adapt new IP from their rides, a la Jungle Cruise most recently. In the third lane, we have our Bad Girl Gone Good villain spotlight movies shown in Cruella and Maleficent. And lastly, we have these type of movies, which honestly have probably become the biggest of all of these. The beat-for-beat live-action remake, usually with a few songs cut and little done to justify why the remake was needed at all. Spoilers, it's for money. So as far as looking at Disney lineup without being a Disney shill that would watch like whatever their 23 brands or whatever.
It's
nauseating. That really is kind of my judgment of their content release and their films that they release. And as we spoke about when we reviewed the Robert Zemeckis Pinocchio remake, I really feel so hopelessly neutral on these films. If there are good qualities, it's most likely done in the animated version. If there are bad qualities, it's because they failed at chasing the animated version or added something entirely new that obviously is going to be a gut reaction from the hardcore fans of these Disney classics and not trying to accept any kind of changes like that. What blows my mind, though, is that the audience that love these remakes, the intended audience for these Disney classics, praise them for not changing too much. That's always what I hear online. They didn't change too much. Oh, it's a good one. They didn't change too much. And it's like, yeah, it's a classic, they say. I say, then why bother feeding the Disney money machine anymore?
Yeah.
If it's that much of a classic, if you're that tied to not altering anything, guess what? Go in the Disney vault and break out the the VHS.
It's a very good argument.
Yeah.
Now, the only other argument is it's great to see it with new effects and live action.
Fair.
You know what I mean? I mean, it is... I can understand it for that,
yeah.
For that matter. Like, I would rather probably watch 2016's Jungle Book than the original Jungle Book.
Okay, fair enough.
It's just visually, it could be visually more appealing.
Sure.
It just looks modern and more new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how the underwater shots are in this one.
Right.
But that is the only argument against that.
Yeah.
Now, your point, exactly right, because
right.
These are classics. Why are you bringing these? If you're just going to,
yeah.
If it's going to be a one-to-one,
mm-hmm.
don't. Touch it. Just don't mess with it.
And I get, the logic internal to Disney is that, oh, well, we need to introduce a new generation to this with, you know, what they're used to as far as those effects and whatnot.
Sure.
I just feel like even on those effects levels, I mean, it's just chasing animation. Do you know how much CGI is in this? It's just animated
it's
at this
whole...
point. You know, it might as well just be animated by another way. Like, I just have such a problem with them.
That's okay.
I mean, we're talking about,
by the way,
a square face being the only human actor of any of the undersea creatures.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I should say, I also kind of agree with you. Don't touch them.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean? Really, I kind of only like the Jungle Book.
It is good. They got walking on that one. So.
But that is so true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Maybe that's a second as well on the positive point. Maybe cast change up could be a positive thing.
Could be a really, really bad thing, though,
right,
too.
Right. Well, yeah, we'll have to. Yeah.
But that's true. All the under. Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
It's true. It's all animation.
It's
anyway.
All, yeah. It's
expensive animation.
Exactly. It's more expensive. I would say, on a positive, our director choice makes a lot more sense than Zemeckis doing Pinocchio. Him working with musicals being his most notable work, in addition to later collabs with Disney, Rob Marshall directed 2002's Chicago, 2009's Nine, and both big live action musicals that certainly helped kind of bring the idea of something so monolithic as Little Mermaid, leading to, you know, what would be leading to the Disney Renaissance, taking that to life and taking iconic songs to life. I think that was a good matchup in director talent. So hats off there. And bringing the Little Mermaid to life is what this sets out to do, as if the one and only film credited with the start of the Disney Renaissance, there are some big shoes to fill here. The story here is identical. Ariel is one of the mermaid princesses of the sea, and wouldn't you think is a girl who has everything. But Ariel dreams of the surface world, fueled by the trinkets that float to the bottom of the sea. During a shipwreck, she saves a sailor named Eric and falls in love with the idea of becoming a part of his world. nearly every adult thinks that's crazy, except one crazy octopus auntie named Ursula, who uses Ariel to get what she wants most, her treasured voice. And that's really an identical setup here. Now, this remake is nearly 1 hour longer and makes the story drag without much substance added to it. There's a new song added in. There's some more drama added to both sides of the relationship, Eric's parents and then Ariel's parents, or just the King of the Sea. But nothing I noticed really enriched the experience. It's just all fluff. And if it was 30 minutes of fluff, that'd be one thing. It's an hour on what is otherwise a snappy 90-minute family cartoon.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just feel like... I wasn't checking every kid in the audience, but I feel that there was some I don't know, some boredom.
Yeah, there was some meandering going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the latest edition of Internet Uproar, the casting of Ariel got people all worked up for casting her being an African-American actress. And let me say clearly, I significantly do not care at all about this. I assure you, folks, the outrage only benefits Disney. Just keep that in mind. Anytime you tweet something out, you are on their marketing budget. That is all it is. So... And more so than anything, I will always judge the performance itself, especially for a musical, if only for a musical. Mm-hmm. And I gotta say, Halle Bailey, not Halle Berry, yeah. Confusing name. We needed a stage name there.
Yeah, you're so right.
It's taken.
It's called the Duke. How about that? Yeah. It's called John Wayne.
But Halle Bailey, she honestly does a wonderful job vocally. I would say, and in the bold claim, if anything, a little better than the original. I was, as my usual process, I listened to the soundtracks. This process, I was listening to both soundtracks side by side. I'm telling you.
And it's actually her singing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. She's a teen star, but I think she has some sort of musical background.
Okay. All right. She's got a set of pipes on her.
Yeah, I'm telling you. And I would not say otherwise, because if anything, my whole position is keep the original, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say we love shitting on kid actors.
If you give me the opportunity.
Yeah.
But no, she's really good on this, and I just feel like I have to say something about it, because there was just such garbage outrage. Again, you're just playing into the pockets.
Right, so. Right.
I can't say much was added in her actual acting in the non-verbal performance that we get in the second act, but when she was singing, she kills it, straight up.
So, okay.
You don't catch me praising Melissa McCarthy too much, but she did a good job as Ursula. Originally, Pat Carolla had such a lavishness to the voice performance of Ursula originally, and McCarthy is able to fill that live-action shoes surprisingly well. Believe me, I was ready to say that she's the worst part, a la Will Smith Genie in the live-action remake.
Mm, okay, yep.
But she was really good, and Tom, let me come clean. Let me document what you mentioned a few weeks ago of how I hear your voice ruining things. Whenever I heard Ursula, I heard your I heard your impression of George in the Jungle saying Ursula.
Ursula?
Not even the real movie. I heard your impression. So maybe that's why I wasn't so hot on the film.
The moment you said her name, by the way, earlier.
You were going to do it.
I was going to do it. Okay.
I'm telling you. And I'll come clean when it happens. I'll be honest.
That's a good one. Yeah. Every time that happens, you should let me know. Yeah. Let it on the podcast.
Ursula? It's great because I hear you, not the actor in George of the Jungle.
The actor is the guy who was in Sideways with Paul Giamatti. Yeah.
Sandman.
Yes, yes. That's really funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so Melissa McCarthy was able to ham it up enough and have and have fun with the role.
Yes.
But also you weren't annoyed by her.
No. And I got to say, I'm really not a fan of her. And I don't really give her films the time of day. So take that.
Right. It's not that you don't like her. Yeah. It's that you don't think about her.
Yeah. I was expecting, like, again, Will Smith Genie, God forbid, a James Corden in Cats. You know what I mean? I was expecting that type of, like, oh, God, this is just terrible.
Yes.
But no, she was good. So. Where, tying back to where I started out with this, that these are just CGI films. These are animated films and remakes of animated films. Mm-hmm. There's an odd choice made here in the fantasy of the underworld. And I'm actually curious of your perspective in mentioning, Jungle Book. You know, mermaids, they're half human. Other sea creatures, however, have a creepy realism to them with zero artistic spin to their design. This is shown perfectly in Sebastian and Flounder, who have zero sidekick cuteness as they are portrayed as realistic sea creatures, like as realistic as possible. Like, why would they do this? I think it's terrible. Flounder specifically was such a miss in this film. In the original, he's so cute and chunky, and his shape is animated in fun ways to accordion out and be, you know, and show his emotions through a way that animated, you know, cartoons can only do. He's just some, like, ugly fish in this. Like, half the time I couldn't even tell if he was on screen, because he just blends in with the other goddamn fish.
Okay, that's very funny.
You know, like...
Well, you know,
from the Jungle Book perspective, what do you think about that?
Well, I've been looking at the stills
and
everything like that. Well, because Jungle Book went for hyper-realism.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And it looked cool, in my opinion, looked cool.
Right.
Now, with these live-action renditions here, I understand that we're mostly animated, we're fake underwater, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how you could go cutesy cartoon when you're in a hyper-realistic type setting.
True. I agree.
Or would you go with the funny, better fish?
I don't know. Yeah, just something. But this real-ass fish was just, like, not doing it for me. Like, and especially, I'm not dying on the sword for Flounder, but, like, he is a highlight of the original Little Mermaid, of just how cute and how fun he's animated.
Sure.
You know?
For
a kid.
Right. But we're not in cutesy animation. Like, I don't know what road you would go down.
Yeah, I know.
I will say that that's a tough...
I think all roads lead to don't remake it.
But, honestly, I would love to watch it just for this aspect.
Sure.
Because, you know, I like to pick this stuff apart. This is kind of what I... If I'm not going to enjoy the movie... You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
Have some fun with it.
Get out of Disney Plus when they shovel it there.
I'm almost surprised that they wouldn't go for a cutesiness with all her friends just for the toy aspect.
Oh, sure.
So it's almost like you're not getting that now.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But I
they're just gonna have you go down to the dock.
Yeah.
Pick out Flounder, little kid. Oh my god. I don't know. This could be nitpicking. It probably is nitpicking, but this is just my aversion to these films. And again, legitimately, I was curious of your perspective, Tom, because it's like, I don't know. I think Jungle Book is the example of maybe it working despite this hyper-realism that they go after.
So with the fish, one thing with the Jungle Book I liked, not only did I like the way they looked, even the way they talked was fine.
Yeah,
like they even made that work okay.
Sure.
How did they do with, like, they're dealing with, like, small fish? Like, how is the talking in the mouth?
It doesn't look like he's moving his mouth. Also, like, there are many scenes where, I forget the seagull's character name, but the seagull, Flounder, and Sebastian, they're, like, on a rock and, like, trying to talk to Ariel, and, like, the Flounder is, like, completely lost in the background because it's, like, in water. Like, I can't see that. Like, I need fisher glasses to see through the water.
That's very funny.
Yeah, so, like, I don't know, man. I just think it's the total opposite of character design. It's burdened by this live action has to equal real life factors, and all these movies shoot for it. So again, it's just something I have at odds with these films. So underwater footage looks acceptable, coming from the Aquaman style of CGI hair floating everywhere to get the effect down. Folks, honestly, please write in if there's a better example of the source of that effect. But I was trying to track down who did the current form of underwater hair equals underwater scene.
One of the Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, good call. Good call.
Was Javier Bardem in one of the...
Yeah, I think one of the later ones, like, if not the last one.
Yeah,
so.
And that's what they... There's some underwater shots there.
Okay.
And I think again...
Good call. It's Disney.
I never liked the look.
Oh, really?
Like, okay. I never liked the look. And, like, even watching some of the clips from this, from this film... I don't know. I really take issue with it, kind of.
Yeah.
And I can't put my finger on it other than I don't love this. I haven't seen the new Avatar. Something tells me I would really prefer that
over
what we've been getting with this
CGI
Aquaman
hair.
CGI hair type thing.
Yeah.
Personally, I just, yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm definitely surprised that this didn't, especially with how big of an IP Little Mermaid is, I'm surprised that this didn't try to... I don't know, grab a fraction of those techniques found in Avatar 2. Maybe the production is just too close that they couldn't adjust.
But at the same time, you said that it actually wasn't bothering you too much here.
It wasn't bothering me, but I had the expectation to be really wowed by the underwater sequences in a movie called The Little Mermaid.
Okay, sure.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So water-based. So I understand like that, though the production's probably overlapped. You know, who knows how long this was, in the pipeline. But I just felt like there could have been maybe, or at least, again, I expected that there was maybe...
Something special with it.
Yeah. because it's, again, it's the Little Mermaid. This next to Aladdin is probably credited with saving Disney. You know what I mean? I expected them to hold no punches, you know, bring out all the guns for this. So budget-wise, maybe.
Yeah, it's weird what they've been doing. It's really weird what they've been doing.
They're making money is what they're doing.
Yeah.
But that's about it, folks. Listen, this is a perfectly fine watch for the family. If you have someone that loves the original, that has not seen the original, it is probably a watch no matter what, as long as they're younger or have a love for other kind of Disney properties. But critically, I think in comparison of the original and this remake, this has so much of a longer runtime that it felt like it just lost the youth audience in my theater a bit. Again, I'm not walking up to them. I'm not taking magnifying glass out. Yeah. But I felt, you know, the longer runtime did kind of lose the intended demographic and the intended audience of this, though. But personally, I really am going to feel identical about all of these remakes. And that also means that they won't fall below a certain standard as well, because they are also upheld by the legend of what these original animated films are. We're going to go ahead and give The Little Mermaid 2023 a 56.
Wow. Okay. It's 56. Yeah, you know, I was really curious to see what you were going to give this one. I thought there was potential there to be less than 50. Mm. I think it makes sense that we're in the 50s, though.
Sure.
Because, you know, like you said, if you're not veering from the main story, which is just an absolute classic now, mm-hmm. then...
Hey, guess what?
You can't get too low, but it's pretty good. Not going to go too high either.
Yeah, you ever see The Little Mermaid?
And that's a 56% right there.
Yeah, I think it where Pinocchio was, I believe, sub-50, I think performances lift this a little bit above, and credit to Halle Bailey and Melissa McCarthy for that.
As far as you said, they added a new song. What was the theming behind the new song, if I can ask?
You're not going to like it.
Okay.
It's like a rap song between Sebastian and the seagull. The seagull's... That was an eye... Folks, that was an eye roll. I mean, but I don't know.
Was it cute?
Yeah.
What was the theme behind it?
It was something about, like, you know, have you heard the squawk?
Okay, all right. So it wasn't anything. It was okay. Okay, all right, all right. 56 for The Little Mermaid.
Well, he wants the track listing.
Well, they changed, like, even like with the Pinocchio, the songs were kind of changed a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's some adult theming and some personal responsibility theming with the Pinocchio story.
Oh, of course. Yeah. A little bit rough on the story.
And that, right. And they changed it. They changed it for the new one. And they made it happier and they made it more like, you know, just self-love.
Inconsequential.
Yeah, and it wasn't about personal responsibility. It was just like, well, do what you want to do, and that's how that is. Like, not like do what you should do.
Sure.
And just changing these small themings a little bit, you know what I mean? And making them more kid-friendly when I don't like it.
Sure.
Of course, we have the great Pinocchio that came out later in the year.
Oh, yeah, Del Toro. Absolutely. That makes up for it single-handedly.
It does, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But, yeah, I think we're on the same page, though, but I really did appreciate your perspective on it with tying back to Jungle Book, because I feel like... That was one of the big hits that I think unleashed the floodgates on further of these remakes.
Yeah, with what they're doing here, the live action remakes. Yeah. Yeah. Because what's funny is, you know, The Lion King kind of came and went. It did well.
I know, right?
It did, not that it didn't do well. It made them money. Mm-hmm. But it still didn't have this punch that maybe you thought it would.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Jungle Book, for whatever reason, maybe it was just me, how it was marketed to me, who knows. But I always liked it, and I always liked that movie. Not the best kid actor, but I did like the movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, Vin, looking at we have very array of films here. So looking back at these, any other last notes, anything for next week's coming up or what? What's up?
We have Spider-Verse for the next week, which I'm excited for.
Yeah, very exciting.
As much as I love the original, I don't think I'm going to revisit it just because I'm a little franchised out and we have Indiana Jones soon enough. So probably going to be more random lists because it's going to be an animation type of release. I was thinking about tackling that last Return of the King animated from the 70s.
Oh, okay. Know? Very cool.
But yeah, that's about it. It'll be whatever's on the list, whatever I'm in the mood for on the spot.
It's a la carte. You just pluck whatever you want there. Yeah, you want a little this, you want a little that, go for it.
Exactly.
You're not tied to anything. Vin, thank you so much for watching all these films here. Thanks for stopping by. We'll see you next week. Folks at home, we're going to run it down one more time here. We have In the Mood for Love with an 82%, Ghost World with a 63%, Babel with a 69%, Sisu with a 64, and finally, The Little Mermaid with a 56%. Folks, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week on the Daily Ratings Podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, if you would, give us a good rating or tell a friend about us. If you're wondering if a film is worth the watch, or if you'd just like to see more movie ratings from Vince, be sure to stop by thedailyratings.com, where we have our ever-expanding catalog of films. Also, if you found value in the podcast or our site, become a producer and go to the donations tab on thedailyratings.com. You can donate whatever amount of value you feel you receive from us. We're looking to build this into something large and great, folks, but we also want to be independent from those corporate sponsors. So we greatly appreciate any support from you all. So thanks so much, and we'll see you next time on the Daily Ratings Podcast.